Help! He shouted, straining his voice to alert his kinsmen to his plight. With any luck, someone would be on their way to retrieve the wayward herd.
Over here!
The cows were calmer now and answered his cries with gentle, mindless moos. Two of the animals ventured to the edge, and sniffing at his hand, licked it heartily. Their saliva collected in a pool, making his position more dangerous than before. It seemed to Belendilin that three grown orcs could not weigh more than he did. His arm was getting longer, while his voice grew hoarse. Suddenly, the herd parted, as someone barged through their midst.
"Over here!"
he called, relieved that help had arrived before he lost his grip.
"I'm falling!"
Dust showered over him, coating his hair and his beard, and he found himself looking into the green face of a gnome, whose sizable nose was tipped with a wart of impressive dimensions. The creature's round eyes stared at him greedily, and its claw-like fingers slithered down his arm.
"Nearly done."
Svert leaned over the edge and fumbled with Belendilin's belt.
"Just one moment," he told the unfortunate dwarf.
A clasp clicked open and Svert straightened up, a look of satisfaction on his face. He brandished Belendilin's purse and the jewel-encrusted belt.
"Much indebted to you, I'm sure. You can let go now."
Chuckling maliciously, he beat his retreat.
"You can't just leave me!"
Belendilin shouted aghast.
"Come back!"
It was too late. His fingers slipped, and in spite of his frantic efforts, he failed to get a purchase on the saliva-covered overhang. He steeled himself for the long slide into darkness. At that moment, an axe sped toward him, the short metal spur catching in the rings of his mail shirt. Belendilin was reeled in like an anchor on a chain. Breathing heavily, he lay on the floor beside his rescuer, who was panting from the strain.
"Gandukar!"
Belendilin could not conceal his astonishment at being saved from his fate by the Fourthling King.
"You and I may not always agree with each other, but we're hardly enemies," said the monarch, smiling wryly. "First and foremost, we're dwarves, children of the smith. Our enemies are Teon's minions, not the other clans or folks. That's how I see it, in spite of our differences."
He straightened up and helped the royal counselor to his feet.
"What happened?"
Belendilin seized his hand thankfully. Gandagar had spoken from the heart, and his heroic intervention was evidence enough of his sincerity.
"Something must have startled the cattle," he said.
He didn't elaborate further. He wasn't prepared to blame Bislipur and Sverd for engineering the accident until he had firm proof. The gnome's appearance on the scene had convinced him that Bislipur was behind his attempted murder. Sverd always acted on his master's command.
"I owe you my life," he said earnestly. "It doesn't mean I think you're right about the elves, but I'm deeply indebted to you all the same."
"Spoken like a true dwarf," the king said warmly. "Besides, I didn't do anything that you wouldn't have done for me."
"Oh, really?"
Belendilin paused and smiled.
"I'm not sure I would have helped."
Gandagar looked at him, shocked.
How could I have rescued you with only one hand?"
Belendilin burst out laughing, and after a short silence, Gandagar joined in. It saddened the counselor that the Fourthling monarch was so determined to go to war. He had a feeling that Gandagar would make an excellent king. Later, when Belendilin regained his chamber, he knew without a shadow of a doubt that the whole episode had been a trap. The delegates who supposedly wanted to see him were an invention. At least his purse and his buckle had been deposited by his door. The gnome must have thought better of harboring evidence of his despicable crime. Belendilin replaced the purse, fastened his belt, and vowed not to give his would-be murderers another chance. Kingdom of Sangpur, Girdlegard, early autumn, 6234th solar cycle. Autumn left the travelers in no doubt that it was a force to be reckoned with, particularly at night. Even though they were deep in the south of Girdlegard, having crossed the border into Queen Umilante's realm, there was little warmth to be found in the desert, only a constant barrage of tiny grains of sand. No sooner had darkness drawn in and the sun sunk below the horizon than the air took on a nasty chill. Andokai wasted no time in lighting a blazing fire, in spite of the twins' disapproval. To Boendal's mind, the comfort it provided was outweighed by the risk of attracting orcs and other riffraff. It seemed foolish to court danger when they had come so far and were almost at their goal. Somewhat begrudgingly, Boindil agreed with him. But the Maegar ignored them anyway and persisted in tossing logs into the flames. They were only 8 or so orbits from Ogre's death when they came to a village among the dunes. The settlement was situated next to a tranquil lake, which made it a popular and flourishing trading post. Tungdil and the others decided to grant themselves the luxury of a night's shelter. For merchants returning home from the Secondling Kingdom, the village was a last oasis before the long journey through Sangpur, where nothing awaited them but desolate wasteland and the occasional brigand.
"It's safe here," Boendal assured them. "The traders like dwarves because they know we offer decent, solid wares that fetch good prices when they sell them in other towns."
The party still attracted considerable attention, but only, as Tungdil realized, because they were accompanied by a walking Tionium tower. Children crowded round them, marveling at Jerun, who bore the fuss with equanimity. The giant was accustomed to causing a stir. Visitors to the settlement were accommodated in tents by the lake. Depending on the needs of each party, the canvas and wood constructions could be expanded or reduced in size, with the option of adding an extra floor to create a two-story dwelling, not dissimilar to a house. Jerun was too tall for a standard model, so they opted for a two-story tent and removed the upper floorboards. The wind was refreshing, so they retreated under the canvas, lit a fire in the corner, and got the kettle boiling.
"Just think," Tungdil said excitedly, sipping his steaming mug of tea. "I'm about to meet my folk. I can hardly wait." "I'm not surprised," Boendal agreed, smiling at him warmly. "And the others will be pleased to meet you too. The delegates will be dying of impatience."
"Ugh," his brother interrupted. "Why would anyone drink this stuff? I'm off to find some beer. There aren't any sensible buildings in this village, but they're bound to sell something that tastes better than tea."
He got up and left. "So tell me, Tungdil," said Andokai, who had been poring over the books, "what makes you special enough to merit a royal escort?" Gorine's letter rested on her knee. It was the first time she had taken any interest in why the twins had been sent to find Tungdil. He hesitated.
"What does it matter?" he said disdainfully. "The estimable Maegar is abandoning Gerdlegard. I don't see why she needs to know."
Andokai broke off her study, taken aback by Tungdil's harsh tone.
"Dear me, I've incurred your eternal displeasure, have I? I'm sorry to disappoint you, but you're wasting your breath if you think you can stop me by appealing to my conscience."
Boendal glanced at Tungdil, eyebrows raised. As far as Tungdil was concerned, the Maegar had no right to give up on her homeland so easily. She wasn't the only one who stood to lose by staying in Gerdlegard. In spite of his excitement at being reunited with his folk, he knew that his chances of survival were slim, unless, of course, there was something in the books that could help them vanquish Nodon. But unlike the Maegar, he was determined to fight beside his kinsmen to the end. Rain pattered against the canvas. Fat droplets left meandering tracks on the outside of the tent and pitted the dusty ground. Autumn showers were nothing unusual in Sangpur's deserts. In most other places, the wet and dry weather would have been ideal for agriculture, but the soil was impossibly barren in these parts. Trees and plants rarely took root and were tended jealously by their owners. Just then, the tent flap swung open and a cloaked intruder appeared in their midst. Like a statue conjured to life, Jerun leapt into action. His left gauntlet closed around his two-hander, then he raised the sword with both hands, dropped into a half-crouch, lunged forward, and brought the blade whistling toward the stranger's throat.
"Stop!"
the Maegar commanded. Jerun froze.
"Forgive me," stammered the man. "I didn't mean to startle you. I was told to deliver this."
Hands trembling, he deposited the keg of beer and fled, worried that the giant would change his mind and cut him down regardless.
"Good work," Boendal said admiringly. "I wouldn't have thought it possible that a man could move so fast wearing all that armor."
Jerun returned to his former position, cross-legged on the floor. Boendal's comment failed to elicit a response from the giant or his mistress. The secondling persevered.
"The warrior is your business," he told Andokai. But our sentries won't let him cross the High Pass unless he's prepared to show his face and declare his lineage.
What kind of foolishness is this? The Magus said irritably, weary of the constant interruptions. We'll be leaving Gerdlegard. What does it matter what he looks like, or where he comes from? You'd be well advised to focus on your defenses instead of interfering in the business of travelers who can't wait to leave your land.
Whether you're coming or going is of no concern to us, Boendal said emphatically. No beast of Teon will set foot on our pass.
Hang on, Tungdil told him. He's just an elongated...
Boendal didn't let him finish.
I played along to keep the peace, but we're almost home now.
He looked at Andokai grimly. When we reach the Blue Range, the giant will be bound by the same laws as everyone else. You're welcome to seek your own route through the mountains, but you won't be crossing our kingdom if you're hiding something dangerous behind that mask.
I'll take my chances, said the Magus, returning to her book.
Your chances! Exploded Boendal. Do you mean we've been traveling all this way with a creature of darkness?
That's not what I said. Besides, I don't recall there being anything in the creed of Samusin to forbid it.
Samusin? I won't have any truck with him!
The dwarf's face hardened, and he rose to his feet, the long shaft of his crow's beak clasped in one hand.
Tell me what's behind the visor! That does it!
Andokai closed her book with a snap.
Nardon himself could be hiding inside that armor, and I wouldn't tell you. Jerun is with me.
If anyone had been wondering how Andokai the Tempestuous had earned her name, the matter was now resolved.
Who cares if he's an ogre, or a dark spirit, or Teon knows what? He's the perfect traveling companion, and he doesn't stink like a pig, which is more than can be said for you and your brother.
Her blue eyes glinted menacingly as she swept the long blonde hair from her face.
He'll raise his visor when he's good and ready, and if you don't like it, too bad.
She pointed toward the main village.
Did you notice the bathhouse on your way in? I recommend you pay it a visit. It's a wonder the birds don't die of asphyxiation when you're around.
She fixed him with an icy stare and opened the second volume with a thud. The silence that followed was broken by the sound of someone running toward the tent. The next moment, Boindil burst through the door.
Pointy ears!
He spluttered.
Pointy ears from Arandur! The trader said they...
He noticed the keg of beer abandoned forlornly on the floor.
I thought you'd be thirsty,
he said, shaking his head in surprise. He pierced the lid with his axe, filled his tankard, emptied it in a single draught, and burped.
Not bad,
he pronounced, helping himself to more.
You were saying?
Andokai reminded him sharply, diverting his attention away from the beer.
Elves!
Boendil sat down on a leather stool.
I bought the keg from a trader who told me what's been happening in Arandur. He thought we'd be drinking to the ruin of the elves. From what he said, their kingdom is all but done for. He reckoned they were scouting Gerdlegard for new places to live.
In Sangpur, the Magus said incredulously. Why come this far south when there's nothing but sand, dust, and stone? It doesn't make sense. What would an elf want with a treeless desert? Tungdil glanced at Boendal, who was clearly thinking on similar lines. It took another sip of beer before his brother caught on.
Are you saying they're Alfar?
He ventured finally. Ideas invariably took longer to penetrate Boindil's mind.
Nodon wants the books, Tungdil explained patiently. A motley company like us doesn't go unnoticed. They must have followed us here and waited until nightfall to enter the settlement. As soon as it's dark, you can't see their eyes, and there's no way of telling they're not elves. In which case, they could be either, Boendal pointed out. I say we post a watch. If they're Alfar, they'll be after us. Why else would they be staying in the village, if not to steal the books? From now on, none of us leaves the tent, no matter what. We'll let them come to us.
Nonsense, we'll go after them,
Boindel said fiercely.
If they're Alfar, we'll kill them, and if they're elves, we'll kill them too. The pointy ears deserve to die.
It had been a while since he'd last used his axes. Andokai listened, then signalled to Jerun and settled down to sleep.
No, brother, ruled Boendal. We'll leave them in peace. The whole village could turn against us if we start a fight. We're not in our own kingdom yet, remember? Cool your temper. I'll take the first watch.
Tungdil yawned and finished his tankard of beer before lying down on a pile of rugs. His fingers clutched the haft of his axe, making him feel a little less exposed. He wasn't sure what to think, but in some ways he was hoping that the Alfar would attack. At least that would persuade Andokai of the importance of the books. Tungdil was just dozing off when a shouted warning woke the desert oasis. The dwarves were on their feet in a flash, weapons at the ready. Andokai had drawn her sword and was monitoring the tent flap and the walls. Axe raised and shield held in front of him, Jerun knelt by the entrance, blocking it like a wall. His helmet glinted, the demonic visor coming alive in the dying firelight. For a fraction of a heartbeat, Tungdil thought he glimpsed a purple glow behind the eyeholes. Boendal damped the flames, lest their shadows be seen through the canvas. The three dwarves stood back to back, the Maegar beside them. For a few moments it was quiet. Then agonized screams rent the air. Now sounds could be heard from the other tents as people emerged from their flimsy shelters, their voices mingling in a clamor of questions as each tried to establish the cause of the noise. Willowy silhouettes and strange shadows flitted across the canvas walls, while all around there was a clunking of metal as shields knocked against tent poles, armor was donned, and weapons were unsheathed. Roused abruptly from its slumber, the village among the dunes was preparing to fight.
"What's going on?" asked Tungdil in a whisper. "Do you think it's a trap?"
Just then, a human voice cried out in terror.
"Orcs!"
Swords met in a ringing din. The battle had commenced. The beasts stopped skulking through the settlement and abandoned all pretense at stealth. Listening to their grunts and snarls, Tungdil was reminded of Goodwater, of Ionandar, of those who had died. He was torn between staying in the tent and running to the aid of the people outside. His instinct was to help, but for all he knew, the Alfar were out there, waiting for him and his companions to emerge.
"What do we do?"
he asked the battle-hardened twins.
"We wait,"
came Boendal's strained reply. He tightened his grip on his crow's beak. The clash of swords was getting louder and more violent, mingled with the screams of dying men. Sounds of fighting echoed from every corner of the village. The orcs had evidently surrounded the settlement and were attacking from all sides simultaneously, making it impossible for anyone to escape. As the fighting raged around them, Tungdil and the others followed the progress of the battle on the walls of their tent, men and orcs locked in combat like figures in a shadow theater. Boindil held a whispered conference with his brother. At last a decision was reached.
"We need to get out of here,"
he announced.
"The runts will sack the settlement, and we can't risk Tungdil getting..."
An orc burst through the tent flap, grunting and waving his sword. He ran full tilt into the expanse of unforgiving metal that was Jerun's shield. Nose gushing with blood, he staggered groggily to the side, only for the giant to hew his collarbone with a downward swipe of his axe. The force of the blow cleaved armor and bones, slicing the orc diagonally in two. Blood and guts spilled from the body in a horrible, reeking mess.
"Hey! I thought I told you to leave the runts to me!"
protested Boindil.
"The next one's mine, all right?"
A second orc stormed into the tent, and Andokai called out to Jerun, who swung his shield obediently to the side. The beast ran on unhindered, failing to notice his fallen comrade or the colossal warrior.
"That's more like it!"
Boindil rushed forward and stopped the beast without ado. Felled by his axes, the orc died with a final grunt.
"No more tomfoolery, Boindil,"
his brother said sternly. He cut a slit in the rear of the tent and peered through the gap.
"All clear."
The sharp blade of his crow's beak tore neatly through the canvas and he slipped outside. When he was sure it was safe, he signaled for the others to follow. They had taken no more than a few paces when a long, slender shadow appeared in front of Boendal and attacked. Only the dwarf's helmet prevented the sword from cleaving his skull. Even so, the force of the blow brought him to his knees.
"Elf or Alf, prepare to die!"
His brother hurled himself at the figure with a blood-curdling shriek. As their assailant stepped back, his cloak fell open to reveal a black metal breastplate that reached to his thighs. His beautiful face and pointed ears removed any doubts about the identity of their attacker. Another Alf appeared out of nowhere and challenged Jerun, while a third bore down on Andokai. Stretching out her hand, the Maga conjured a glimmering black sphere and cast a bolt of lightning in his direction. Tungdil expected the creature to burst into flames, but his hopes were disappointed. The Alf produced an amulet, which intercepted the spluttering charm, absorbing the magic and leaving the target unharmed. Cursing, the Maga drew her sword. Tungdil glanced round, looking for a possible fourth attacker. To his horror, an Alf leapt from a nearby cart and landed in front of him. His eyes took in the crimson gloves, long spear, and golden hair. It was one of the two Alfar who had parleyed with the orcs near Goodwater.
Synthoros!
His lips appeared to be moving.
Speak up!
Commanded Tungdil, dwarven bloody-mindedness conquering his fear. He had no intention of surrendering.
Look at me. Synthoros is your death.
The fair-haired Alf whispered softly.
I will take your life, as I have taken the life of every groundling before you.
We'll see about that! Vrakas helped us kill one of your kind in Greenglade, and he'll help us again!
Tungdil decided not to wait for the Alf to attack.
For Lot Ionan and Frala!
Raising his axe, he charged. Synthoros laughed, easily evading the energetic but poorly planned attack. Realizing at once that he was dealing with a novice, he decided to have some fun with his victim before dealing the fatal blow. His spear flashed forward, its long, tapered point boring through Tungdil's male shirt and passing through his undergarments. The tip pierced his left shoulder, deep enough to hurt him, but too shallow for serious harm. The wound enraged the dwarf further, and he redoubled his efforts, little realizing that the Alf was toying with him. Slowly but surely, Synthoros drew his victim away from his companions, leading him into the jumble of tents. While the Alf skipped and danced ahead, Tungdil blundered among the guy ropes and tent pegs, grimly focused on staying on his feet. The Alf's weapon approached with such speed that Tungdil gave up trying to block its attack. One moment the creature would be in front of him, the next his spear would be buried in his back. He was losing blood from myriad perforations that smarted abominably. At last, Tungdil looked round and realized his mistake. Amid the confusion of ropes and tents, he had lost sight of the others, and even the giant was gone. A moment later, Synthoros vanished as well. The Alf was enjoying his murderous little game. Wherever Tungdil looked, men were fighting with a courage born of despair, knowing with grim certainty that the orcs would show no mercy. Meanwhile, the beasts kept coming at them, more determined than ever to sink their teeth into the traders and their wares. A number of tents had been pulled to the ground, and the canvas caught fire. Flames and glinting swords reflected in the surface of the lake, the watery image of destruction warped by rippling waves.
Where are you hiding?
Tungdil was learning to his cost that the Alfar were harder to deal with than orcs. He decided to rejoin his friends while he still had the chance. But Synthoros wasn't finished with him.
Over here.
The Alf loomed up behind him, thrusting his spear violently into the dwarf's right shoulder. Something seemed to tear inside Tungdil's arm, the pain surging through him like liquid fire. His hand opened and the axe fell from his grasp. The dwarf's tormentor pulled his legs from under him, tipping him face first to the ground. Crouching over him, Synthoros threaded the spear through his male shirt on a level with his heart. The metal spike ground against the rings.
What did I tell you?
Said a whisper in Tungdil's ear.
Synthoros is your death. It would have been wiser to leave the books in Greenglade, but it's too late for that now.
Go ahead and kill me, but answer me one thing. What do you want with the books?
Synthoros laughed.
Only a groundling could be so simple-minded. To think that you've been lugging around the volumes and you don't even know what they are.
He thought for a moment.
They're precious, more precious than anything you can imagine. A single syllable is worth a sack of gold. They could make you the wealthiest being in Gertlegard, or the most powerful if you kept the secret to yourself. Acting on their contents would make you a hero beyond compare.
He leaned on his spear and lowered his voice to a malicious whisper.
All this you had, but you lost it. I'll take even more pleasure in killing you now.
Tungdil shuddered as the elf muttered unintelligibly in his own dark tongue. At any moment, the spear would reach his heart and put an end to his life. Before the weapon could penetrate farther, a shadow fell over them, and something whirred through the air. The elf dove to safety, only this time the maneuver was anything but elegant. He hit a tent, the canvas collapsing around him. Jeroen strode past the stricken dwarf and went after the elf. Using the lower edge of his shield as a knife, he beat down on the muffled body, first with his shield, then his axe, until the bloodied canvas lay still. Three orcs tried to stop him, but were slain on the spot. Tungdil wondered whether he was hallucinating when he saw what happened next. The giant, whose back was turned to Tungdil, opened his visor, or so the dwarf concluded from the movement of his arm, and tore a chunk of flesh from an orcish corpse. He raised the dripping meat toward his face.
What is he doing?
Grunting with pain, Tungdil lifted himself onto his knees, leaned on his axe for support, and called to the giant. Jeroen whirled round in surprise and pushed down his visor. In the light of the burning tents, Tungdil caught a brief glimpse of a skull with wide jaws, long fangs, and slits for eyes. The helmet clicked into place, and violet light glimmered through the demon's eyes. The chunk of flesh had vanished, but it was obvious from the mutilated corpse and the green blood dripping from Jeroen's gauntlet that something extraordinary had occurred.
He's not an orc or an ogre, so what kind of creature is he?
Jeroen gestured with his axe in the direction from which he had come. Tungdil followed his lead, relying on the giant to slay the orcs who barred their path. He was finding it difficult enough to walk with his injuries. Before they were out of the maze of tents, Bowindil rushed toward them, a panicked look on his face. His lips twitched and his jaw tightened when he saw the blood on Tungdil's shirt. He didn't need to be told that the giant had saved his charge's life. The trio hurried on, arriving in time to see Andokai drive her sword through the neck of a dying elf, who was flailing at her feet. She snatched up the amulet that had warded off her magic power. Her leather armor seemed to strain at the seams as she gasped for breath, her physical strength exhausted. She greeted Tungdil with a brief nod, then led the company out of the village on a southerly bearing. Between them, Jeroen, the twins, and the Maegar had put pay to three Alfar. Boendar stoically ignored the blood trickling down his neck. It took more than a blow to the head to make a dwarf complain. Tungdil gritted his teeth and followed at the rear. His wounds could be bandaged just as soon as they had got the books to safety, which meant throwing off Nodon's henchmen and making their way to Ogre's death as quickly as they could. Three orcish sentries were waiting for them at the top of a dune. Jeroen drew his sword.
That's enough from you, Longan.
In no time, Ironheart was at his side, hacking savagely at the beasts. The rage he felt at neglecting his duty to Tungdil was channeled into his blows, and he cut down two of the beasts in the time it took Jeroen to slay one.
At least I'm faster than you, he told the giant.
Down in the village, the noise of the battle was fading. From the jeering and grunting, it was obvious that the orcs had prevailed against the inhabitants of the desert's lone oasis. Flames were spreading from tent to tent, and the orcs were loading chopped-up corpses onto carts. A band of runts spotted the travelers on the crest of the dune and set off in pursuit. Two dozen beasts scrambled up the sandy slope behind them.
You'd think they'd have the sense to give up.
Andokai waited until they were almost upon them, then raised her arms and uttered an incantation. A tearing wind swept out of nowhere, gusting and circling, until it formed a tornado 4 paces in diameter, becoming stronger and fiercer with the Maegar's every word. Sand, scree, and boulders were sucked into its midst. Then, on Andokai's command, the gale unleashed its force on the orcs, who were hanging back in confusion. The wind and debris peeled the skin from their bones. Grunting and yelping, the orcs fled the lethal gust.
"Carry on without me," Andokai told the dwarves. "I'll keep the orcs busy for a while."
The trio resumed their march, and soon the Maegar was back in their midst, with Jeroen behind them, on the lookout for any attacks from the rear. This time, though, the orcs let them go. Unlike the Alfar, they weren't equipped to deal with magic, and the night of looting and destruction had been profitable enough.
Chapter 10. Beroeinsfolk, Secondling Kingdom, Girdlegard, Early Autumn,
6,234th solar cycle.
I call on the Assembly to decide the matter without further delay, said Gandagar loudly,
his voice ringing out across the Great Hall. With the intention of cutting a regal figure, he had put on full mail and was wearing his diamond-encrusted helmet.
30 orbits have passed. 30 orbits in which...
He continued his address, the chieftains and elders listening in silence. Gundrabur's eyes were closed, and the ceremonial hammer was resting on the arms of his marble throne. His counselor was following the speech without visible emotion. He had not succeeded in uncovering any evidence to incriminate Bislapur or Sverd, and worse still, the mood among the delegates was tipping in favor of war.
You saw the smoke. It came from a village across the border with Sangpur.
Turning slowly, Gandagar scanned the semicircle of dwarves. He knew he had to make eye contact if he wanted to win their trust.
The settlement was razed to the ground by orcs. Teon's runts are marauding through the countryside, brazenly attacking the races of Gerdlegard. We can't afford not to know who our next leader will be. Every orbit brings new dangers. According to the traders, strange things are happening in the Enchanted Realms, and Alandor is in turmoil. Some say that the elves have abandoned their kingdom, and are scouting for land elsewhere. We must act!
Here or in Alandor?
Said a bewildered voice from the benches.
Here and in Alandor,
bellowed Bislapur, before Gandagar had a chance to reply. His dwarven blood was boiling over with impatience, and he couldn't endure the prospect of another interminable speech.
Alandor must be invaded before the pointy ears give us the slip and vanish Vrakas knows where.
He raised a clenched fist.
Destroy the elves and avenge our murdered kin!
The call was taken up by most of the delegates, although a few of their number abstained from the general excitement, some signaling their disagreement by frowning or shaking their heads. Gandagar's gaze settled on a chieftain who was wearing his withered elf's ear with pride. The call to arms had been resoundingly successful, but there was still the matter of the succession, and the elderly monarch showed no sign of preparing to vacate the throne. At that moment, Gundrabur's eyes opened wearily.
Silence! He commanded. Baying for blood like beasts! You should be ashamed of yourselves!
He raised a gnarled hand and pointed to the dwarf who was sporting the grisly trinket.
Get rid of it!
The chieftain looked to Gandagar for support. Seizing the hammer, the High King rose from the throne and made his way from the dais to confront the disobedient dwarf. His wrinkled fingers gripped the chain and snapped it from the delegate's neck. The shriveled ear dropped to the floor.
I'm not dead yet, and while I'm your High King, I shall set our course,
he thundered.
The Assembly will wait. No,
Gandagar contradicted him.
We have waited long enough. Beyond these walls, orcs are laying waste to Gerdlegard. And the elvish villains are getting away! I will sit and wait no longer!
Belendilin stepped down from the platform and strode over to the Fourthling monarch.
You forget yourself, he said, hand resting lightly on his belt. The High King deserves your respect.
The reprimand was delivered without any of the usual formalities behooving Gandagar's rank.
The High King has been wearing a crown for too many cycles to know what's best for our folks.
Gandagar snapped back.
I won't put up with this nonsense any longer. Why should I sit back and do nothing when we should be seizing our opportunity and getting vengeance on the elves? Alandor is as good as defeated. We need to attack while we can, not sit here wasting our energy on pointless discussions. Orbit after orbit, all we ever do is talk and drink.
Belendilin squared his shoulders.
Think carefully before you continue, King Gandagar. Our laws were not made to be broken by you.
He pointed to the stone stelae engraved with the sacred commandments of the dwarves.
They're the very basis of our existence. Defy them, and you'll be endangering the fragile unity of the folks. Why not take a hammer to the tablets if that's your intention? By all means, write your own laws. But remember, history will be your judge.
Hand on his axe, Bislapur stepped forward, positioning himself at Gandagar's side. The atmosphere in the Great Hall was unbearably tense. For the first time, it seemed that the difference of opinion was going to end in blows. Suddenly, the doors swung open.
Get out!
Gandagar shouted furiously.
We don't need more confounded beer!
But this time, the interruption wasn't the fault of attendants bearing tankards. A herald walked in.
The second candidate has arrived,
he announced. The delegates whirled round and stared excitedly at three squat figures silhouetted in the doorway. Behind them stood a human female and an armored giant. A buzz of whispers filled the room.
Let me speak with him, said a visibly relieved Gundrabur. The assembly is dismissed.
Balindelin helped him back to the throne, and they waited for the delegates to leave the hall. The departing dwarves cast curious glances at the stranger standing between the twins, but no one dared to address him. Then Bislapur drew level. He stopped and took a menacing step toward Tungil.
You're not one of us, he said scornfully. Go back to Lot Ionin, and leave us to settle our own affairs. You needn't have bothered coming. We've decided on a successor already.
Oh, really? Let's hope he's as good as this one, Boendal said coolly.
He stepped in front of his charge.
Didn't you hear what Gundrabur said? The assembly is dismissed.
Boendil joined him and flashed the Fourthling advisor an insolent smile.
Looking for trouble, are you? I'll shave your miserable chin with my axes. You see if I don't.
Bislapur merely snorted and left. The doors closed behind him, shutting Andukai and Jerun outside. The High King motioned for the trio to approach. He and his counselor looked at Tungdil warmly.
The lost dwarf has returned to his kinsfolk, he said, rising to clap a hand on his shoulder. Thanks be to Vrakus for bringing you here.
Tungdil bowed his head, overcome with emotion. He wanted to say something, but his throat was dry with excitement. He felt sweaty and grubby, and his body ached all over, in spite of Boindil's efforts to treat his wounds. In fact, the shoulder that the High King was gripping was particularly sore. All in all, he was too tired and disheveled to appear before Gundrabur, but the King of all Dwarves generously refrained from commenting on his state. The monarch turned to the twins.
You've done yourselves and the Secondlings proud. Ogre's death boasts no finer warriors than you,
he lauded them.
You can be sure of my gratitude. Retire to your chambers and get some rest.
Boindil stared at the floor, uncomfortable at being praised. He hadn't forgiven himself for what had happened in the desert oasis, when Tungdil had nearly been killed. It was mortifying to think that his charge would have died without Jerun. Gloomily, he left the hall with his twin.
You'll hear our side of the story in a moment, promised Balindelin. But why don't you tell us about your journey first?
This was the moment that Tungdil had been waiting for. He tried to swallow his nerves, but it was hard not to be distracted by the Great Hall's monumental galleries, pillars, and statues. It was all so very dwarven.
Gladly, he said.
But what of Andukai and Jerun? They were loyal protectors during our travels. I trust they will be provided for. Without really meaning to, he had adopted a more flowery way of speech, perhaps because of his magnificent surroundings. Balindelin gave his word that the Maegar and her companion would be taken care of. So Tungdil launched into his account, beginning with Lot Ionin, the vaults, and his errand, then proceeding by means of the Black Saddle, Greenglade, the fate of the Magi, the treachery of Nudin, or Nadon, as he called himself, his run-in with the bounty hunters, Gareen's mysterious books, and the Alfar's attempts to track them down, then concluding with the Magus's threat to the Dwarven Kingdoms and his plans to bend Girdlegard to his will. Soon his cheeks were flushed with talking, but he tried to state the facts plainly, without glossing over the horror or embellishing his report. He spoke without faltering, save for one occasion when he was understandably thrown. It happened when three serving girls opened the doors and walked into the hall. Tungdil, who yearned to become acquainted with the fairer sex, was transfixed by the mysterious creatures who had colonized his imagination for as long as he could remember. They were a little shorter than he was, and not as broadly built, but their ample robes betrayed an unmistakable fullness of figure. Fine, almost imperceptible fluff covered their plump faces from the cheekbones to the lower jaw. The wispy down matched the color of their hair, and unlike his own bristly whiskers, their furry skin seemed soft and smooth. This, then, was the origin of the myth about bearded women. Tungdil found them utterly beguiling. His remaining composure crumbled when they turned to him with shy, friendly smiles. His heart started beating so wildly that he had to abandon his story until they were gone. Gundrabur and Balendilin made no comment, although the one-armed counselor could barely suppress a grin. At last Tungdil concluded his report, ending with a brief account of the attack on the desert oasis. He reached for his tankard, which smelled enticingly of beer. The dark liquid washed over his thirsty lips, coating his tongue with its powerful malty flavor. A single sip was enough to convince him that humans knew nothing of beer. It tasted so good that he could have kissed the dwarf who had invented the recipe, but instead he took another swig.
"These are ill tidings," Gundrabur said sadly. "We intend to be honest with you, Tungdil, so you shall hear of our problems too."
His counselor described the dwarves' predicament, including the proposed war, the question of the succession, and the rift among the delegates, as succinctly as he could.
"It seems from what you've told us that an alliance is imperative. The races of Girdlegard must unite and fight together against the perished land."
Tungdil sighed.
"An alliance won't save us if we can't make sense of the books or the artifacts. There must be a way of getting to Nodon, or he wouldn't be so afraid. The trouble is, we can't do anything without Andekai, and she's determined to wash her hands of Girdlegard. Without her power and knowledge, our chances of defeating the evil are no better than any of the other realms."
"And we must watch powerlessly while the northern blight advances," Gundrabur murmured somberly, closing his eyes. "Then it is settled. I shall appeal to the Maegar for help."
Tungdil said nothing, although he doubted the efficacy of the scheme. No amount of dwarven reasoning could influence the workings of the Maegar's mind. The thought of Andekai reminded him that Jerun had been permitted to enter the stronghold without raising his visor. At the time, it hadn't occurred to him, and it clearly hadn't registered with the sentries or the twins, who had blithely waved the armored warrior through their gates.
"She must have put a spell on us."
He decided not to say anything, least of all to Boindil, whose hot temper would explode in incandescent fury. The last thing they needed was for Jerun to be challenged to a duel. He took the opportunity to broach the subject of the succession.
"I don't mean to sound ungrateful," he said, determined to nip the matter in the bud. "You've done me a great service in reuniting me with my folk. But I can't be made king. I was raised by Longans and learned the dwarven ways from books. Extremely inaccurate books, I might tell you. My rival is a much more suitable candidate. So I intend to renounce my claim and vote in favor of him. We need a high king whom everyone will respect."
"Your speech and sentiments do you credit," Gundrabur praised him. "But the fact is, we made up the story about your birth. Lothionen played along because we swore him to secrecy. I'm afraid you have no claim to the throne. There's no proof that you're even a fourthling."
Tungdil's mind was reeling.
"But why? I mean, I don't see why you made me come all this way just to tell me it isn't true."
"Think of all the good that has come of it already," Balendilin said soothingly. "It's put us in a better position to do something about Nodon. And if we hadn't sent the twins to look for you, the orcs would have killed you in Greenglade."
"True, but..."
He fumbled for the right words.
"What of the delegates? All this time the assembly has been waiting for me, and I'm not even a genuine heir."
He felt as if the ground had been tunneled from under his feet. After the ordeals of his journey, he had just been getting comfortable, and now he had nowhere to call home.
"Please don't be angry with us,"
Gundrabur entreated him.
"If Gandogar is crowned, our race will be locked in combat with the elves, and we can't let that happen. Our idea was to postpone Gandogar's appointment until the Assembly had been persuaded of the folly of waging war. When your Magus wrote to us with news of a foundling dwarf, we took the liberty of inventing a story about your lineage to buy some extra time."
We were hoping to find a solution, an ancient law or such like that would force the Assembly to vote against war,
Belendilin explained.
Fighting the elves would be ruinous for both our races, but Gandagar just won't see it. I expect you think we're as dishonest as kobolds, but our intentions are honorable. We want the best for our race.
Tungdil kept his mouth shut for fear of saying something he might regret. He helped himself to more beer and emptied the tankard in a single draught.
And did you find anything?
Not exactly, the High King confessed. That's why we're asking you to join our conspiracy and challenge Gandagar for the throne.
What good would it do? Tungdil shrugged. They'd never elect me.
No, agreed Gundrabur, but if I'm not happy with the Assembly's choice of heir, I can veto the succession.
And what then? Would you rather our folks fought each other than wage war on the elves? It won't come to that,
Belendilin reassured him.
Our laws state that the heir must challenge his rival to a duel. Of course, the rival candidate would have to be backed by some of the chieftains and elders, but roughly a third of the delegates have been won over to our cause. That should suffice.
And then Gandagar will have the privilege of slicing me in two, Tungdil scowled.
I still don't see how it changes anything.
The High King and his counselor exchanged glances.
Swear that you won't breathe a word of this to anyone,
Belendilin demanded, eyeing Tungdil solemnly until he complied.
We need to banish Bislipur and Sverd from Gandagar's circle. Bislipur is obsessed with the idea of wiping out the elves, and his zeal has rubbed off on Gandagar. Thanks to Bislipur's constant whispering, the Fourthling King rarely has time to think for himself.
He frowned.
The villain tried to kill me. I can't prove it yet, but I will.
But assuming you succeed, Tungdil said doubtfully, won't Gundagar still go ahead with his plan?
We'll open his eyes to the perfidy of his mentor and the folly of an elven war. Gundagar is a good dwarf at heart. His advisor is to blame.
Belendilin paused and looked at Tungdil intently.
But I need more time, and for that we're depending on your help.
You'll be doing your kinsmen a great service,
Gundrabur assured him.
They'll realize it eventually. History will record how a foundling dwarf named Tungdil was hewn by Vrakas to save his children from destruction.
I'll do it, agreed Tungdil.
But I'll need your full support.
We'll do everything we can for you, promised Belendilin. You're an honorable dwarf, Tungdil. Forgive us for burdening you with our troubles before you've even had a chance to rest. Now that we've settled the important business, you should get some proper sleep. You'll have one orbit in which to recover and prepare yourself for the hustings.
The one-armed counselor smiled at him encouragingly.
Buy us some time, and we'll forge a better future without the likes of Bislipur,
the High King exhorted him. He picked up the ceremonial hammer and held it out to the dwarf.
Swear on the hammer that brought us into being that you won't tell a soul.
Tungdil gave his word and left the great hall. Outside, Andukai and Jerun were still waiting in the corridor.
They said we could stay for a while, she said evenly.
As it happens, I could do with a break. These past few orbits together have been horribly stressful.
My sentiments exactly, said Tungdil,
leaving the Maegar to decide whether it was the journey or her company that he found such a trial. An attendant arrived to take them to their rooms. As they followed, Tungdil marveled at the splendor of their surroundings. The masons had worked the walls with incredible finesse, and the smooth surfaces were decorated with sculpted reliefs and chiseled inscriptions. Dwarven runes inlaid with precious metals shimmered in a kaleidoscope of silver, gold, and red. But what really caught his attention was the staircase. He had always thought of steps as being rectangular, smooth, and plain. These were a revelation. Each slab of stone was different from the next. The flat treads decorated with elaborate patterns and the uprights engraved with runes. It was only when he read the runes in sequence that he realized the purpose of the design. The staircases spelled out stories that served to distract the weary secondlings from the grueling ascent. Tungdil could tell from Andukai's expression that she too had noticed the runes and was reading with interest. The stories told of glorious days of old, evoking heroic adventures, each more impressive than the last. Tungdil climbed eagerly, relishing every step, until at length they reached their chambers. Andekai disappeared inside her room before he could inquire about the books. He was sure that her change of heart was connected to something she had seen or read. Maybe Gundrabor will be lucky, he thought hopefully, as he shuffled to bed.
That's the beauty of being among friends, said a deep voice. You don't even have to lock the door.
Tungdil woke with a start and sat up drowsily, only to discover Bislapur in his room.
Good morning, Tungdil.
Somehow the greeting sounded suspiciously insincere.
We'll talk properly at the hustings, but I'm sure you're as impatient as I am to have a little chat.
I wasn't really expecting visitors, Tungdil said hesitantly.
The sudden appearance of Gandagar's advisor had thrown him slightly. In fact, now that he thought about it properly, walking in without an invitation was downright rude. His friendly feelings towards Bislapur as a kinsman had withstood their bristly encounter in the Great Hall, but this was something else. Bislapur sat down on the bed and gave him a long stare.
You think you're one of us, do you? He mocked. A poor little foundling, raised by a wizard, but of genuine royal blood. It sounds like a fairy tale, doesn't it?
He leaned forward.
Because it is. I'm not going to beat about the bush. You're an impostor. What proof do you have of your lineage?
You'll see soon enough, Tungdil said firmly.
If it hadn't been for his conversation with Gundrabur and Belendilin, he would have stepped aside for his rival. Only last night he had been assailed by doubts about the wisdom of maintaining the deception, but now, thanks to Bislapur's obnoxious behavior, his mind was made up.
None of the Fourthlings can remember a case of a missing child.
And I suppose you know them all in person and every detail of their lives. That's really quite a claim.
Tungdil stood up. He had a feeling that the long hours spent reading in Lotayonan's library and studying the art of disputation would stand him in good stead. All of a sudden, he felt naked without his chainmail and his weapon. He threw on his tunic and belted his axe to his waist. His confidence flooded back.
Wait until tomorrow, and you'll hear the full story.
I've got a better idea, said Bislapur. Cancel the hustings, and we'll adopt you as one of our folk. All we ask is that you agree to back Gandugar. Retract your claim, and you'll never want for anything.
Supposing I refuse?
Supposing you refuse?
Bislapur laid a muscular hand on his axe.
If you refuse, you'll see what happens when a Fourthling, or a fake Fourthling in your case, turns against the leader of his folk. None of us will submit to your rule. Even if you're elected, you'll never really be king.
Tungdil could tell from the muffled fury in his voice that Bislapur meant business.
That's for the assembly to decide, not you, he informed him, doing his best to sound like a prospective monarch. Now go, he commanded.
Supposing I refuse,
the thick-set dwarf said mockingly.
Supposing you refuse,
thundered Tungdil, placing a hand on his axe.
If you refuse, I'll throw you out myself. I've dealt with enough orcs and Ulfar to know what to do with a dwarf who sneaks his way into my chamber while I'm asleep.
His brotherly tolerance of Bislapur had given way to undisguised dislike.
Get out!
Bislapur wavered for a moment, unsure whether he should commit to a trial of strength. To Tungdil's relief, he decided to see himself out.
You'll regret this,
he threatened by way of a farewell.
That's a risk I'm prepared to take, Tungdil retorted.
Alone in his chamber, he stood in front of the mirror, put his hands on his hips, and squared his shoulders. Rather than get dressed, he practiced looking steely until he was confident of his ability to assume a determined expression whenever he pleased. It took considerable willpower not to crawl back into bed. He was in the process of removing his nightshirt when someone knocked on the door. Without waiting for an answer, a female dwarf in a skirt and leather blouse strode in and placed some fresh linen on the marble dresser. She giggled when she saw him rooted to the spot.
I should say something, he thought,
racking his brains desperately, but already she was gone.
I guess it takes practice,
he muttered, pulling on his clothes absent-mindedly. His mind was whirring with a thousand different thoughts. It was dispiriting to know that he was still a foundling dwarf, For the first time in his life, he was surrounded by others of his race, but deep down he was the loneliest soul in all Girdlegard. In fact, he'd been better off when he'd lived among humans. At least then he'd belonged to Lot Ionan and the school. It didn't help that he was obliged to pose as a fourthling and put on a show of happiness at being reunited with his folk. For all his honest intentions, it made him feel like a terrible fraud. Keen to distract his thoughts, he reread Lot Ionan's letter about his provenance, memorizing every fabricated detail until he was sure that none of the delegates could pick a hole in his story. There was nothing else to do in his chamber, so he wandered into the corridor and roamed the majestic stone passageways while his stomach growled hungrily. Dwarves streamed past him, clad in leather aprons and covered in a dusting of rock. Tungdil guessed from their appearance that they were heading for the quarry. They smiled and called out to him, and he returned their greetings with a nod. Soon afterward he was intercepted by an attendant, who marched him off to breakfast. Tungdil understood the real purpose of the summons when he was welcomed to the table by Belendilin, who wanted to prepare him for the hustings. "It's all under control," the counselor assured him. The trinkets on his braided beard swung back and forth as he spoke, which earned him fascinated glances from Tungdil. "Three dwarves from Gandagar's delegation have agreed to say they remember hearing a rumor about a missing child. Their testimony, together with a letter from your Magus, should give us the credibility we need. After that, you'll make your speech, and then..." "My speech?" said Tungdil, looking up sharply from the array of pungent cheeses, salamis, pickled mushrooms, and roasted lichen. All of a sudden, he stopped caring about the absence of ham, porridge, and bread. The prospect of addressing the assembly had banished any thought of food. "It needn't be terribly long. You can talk a bit about your journey and your encounters with Nadon and the Perished Land. You'll lose the vote, of course, but that's no great inconvenience. We'll proceed to the next stage of our plan." Belendilin's eyes twinkled. "It's all under control," he said again.
"Oh, I'm glad you think so."
Tungdil sighed and piled his wooden plate with a small helping of everything. He told the counselor of Bislapur's visit.
"That's just the kind of underhanded behavior I'd expect from him."
Belendilin seemed to take the news in stride.
"You know what it means, don't you? We're on the right track. The scoundrel wouldn't bother with you unless he thought you were a threat."
Tungdil didn't share his optimism. He hadn't forgotten that Bislapur had tried to murder Belendilin, and he saw no reason to suppose that the fourthling wouldn't do the same to him.
"There's one more thing," said the counselor. "The Maegar and her bodyguard have gone."
"Gone?"
Tungdil echoed aghast.
"So she's really left us. How could she give up like that and leave Girdlegard to its fate?"
"When did she leave?" "This morning, just after dawn. We had to let her cross the pass. There wasn't any justification for detaining her, and besides, how do you stop a Maegar?"
"You don't."
Tungdil put his head in his hands. It was hopeless. No one apart from Andokai had anything like Nadon's power, and now she was searching for force fields beyond the Blue Range. She must have given up on Gareen's books.
Why couldn't one of the other Magi have survived instead?
He felt certain that Myra or Lot Ionan would have stayed and led the fight against the traitor.
"We'll have to rely on you to decipher the tomes," said Belendilin. "You can always consult our archives if you think they'll be of use."
"You should ask your historians. I'm sure they'd do a better job than me," muttered Tungdil.
Belendilin shook his head.
"They don't know the Magi's writings as well as you do. No one understands the Longans better than you."
He looked encouragingly at the dejected dwarf.
"I know it's a heavy burden, but a great deal is at stake. We'll never forget it."
"I'll do my best,"
he promised, forcing down his mouthful. He hiccuped discreetly. His palate had adjusted to the cheese, but his stomach was proving less adaptable, not unreasonably, considering the quantities involved. To round off the meal, he poured a mug of sour milk and stirred it through with a spoonful of honey. Dwarven cuisine was a lot better than he had thought. Excusing himself from the table, he made his way back to his chamber, this time looking fixedly at the floor so as not to be distracted by the magnificent marble carvings. The speech that was taking shape in his mind was going to cover all the events of the previous weeks and more. Tungdil drained the strong malt beer from his tankard, wiped his beard, and looked up at the assembly. The delegates had listened patiently while he'd read out Lotionen's letter and tried to establish his lineage as the illegitimate offspring of the dead Fourthling king. True to their word, three of Gandagar's chieftains claimed to recall a rumor about a missing heir. Bislipur instantly accused them of lying.
"I expect you're wondering why I think I would make a good king," said Tungdil, raising his voice above the tumult.
The beer had settled his nerves and quashed his inhibitions about appearing before an assembly of dignitaries and chieftains.
"The fact is, I know better than anyone the dangers that lie ahead. I know the power of the Perished Land, and I know we need to stand united. It would be fatal to squander our strength on a campaign against the elves. Their numbers may have dwindled, but their army is not to be mocked."
"We are not afraid of the Pointy Ears,"
Bislipur shouted, incensed.
"Maybe not, but dead heroes are no use to us at all," Tungdil retaliated. "The elves have been fighting the Alfar for hundreds of cycles. What chance would we have of defeating them? Their bowmen are the best in Gurdlegaard. Before we get within 300 paces, they'll bombard us with arrows."
"Not if we sneak up on them," Bislipur objected.
"You can't honestly believe they won't notice an army of 1,000 dwarves. Friends, this war will end in our defeat."
He looked at them beseechingly.
"Darkness has eaten its way into the heart of our lands. Vrakus entrusted the safety of Gurdlegaard to our race. It's our duty to defeat Nodon and expel Teon's minions. And if the elves and humans are able to help us, we must ally ourselves with them."
"The High King's puppet has learned his part well," sneered Gandagar.
"Our minds think alike, because we both see reason. If there was anything between your ears but sheer bloody-mindedness, you might see sense as well."
A ripple of laughter swept through the room.
"The elves must be punished,"
shouted Bislipur, drawing himself up to full height.
"You heard how they betrayed our kinsfolk and allowed Teon's beasts to storm the stone gateway. Their crimes cannot go unavenged."
"And what of Nodon? A war against the elves would weaken us dangerously."
Tungdil thumped his hand against the marble.
"Of course, if we really want to make things easy for the Magus, we could always open our stronghold to the Orcish invaders. Is that what you want? Maybe you should ask the Runts if they'd like to join us in a campaign against the elves."
He waited for the commotion to settle.
"In my possession are two tomes belonging to Lotionen, in whose household I was raised. Once I have unlocked their meaning, we will hold the key to defeating Nodon and the Perished Land."
He neglected to mention that even Andokai had failed to make sense of the books.
"Just think of the glory if the dwarves were to save Gurdlegaard. Our heroism would humiliate the Pointy Ears far more than military defeat."
There was a hum of excitement from the benches. Books that could defeat the Perished Land, that was news indeed.
"He's lying!"
roared Bislipur.
"Since when did magic ever help the dwarves? It brings us nothing but trouble. Magic is to blame for the Dark Wizard's power. I say we fight the elves, then retreat to our ranges until the humans have settled the matter for themselves,"
added Gandagar, springing to his feet. He hurried to the middle of the assembly to be sure of the delegate's attention.
"Don't listen to the foundling who learned our lore from books. He'll never understand our ways."
He laughed.
"A high king who knows nothing of his race. It's downright ridiculous."
"It can't be that ridiculous, or you wouldn't be so het up,"
Tungdil said pointedly. There was another low rumble of laughter. He was doing Lotionen proud with his witticisms, although the beer could take some of the credit.
"I mustn't get carried away," he told himself.
Gundrabur had heard enough. He raised the hammer and pounded it against the marble table.
"Both candidates have made their cases, and the assembly must decide. Delegates, remember you are voting for your future High King. Those in favor of Gandagar Silverbeard of the Clan of the Silverbeards, raise your axes."
Tungdil counted the glistening blades. To his great surprise, Gandagar's share of the vote had dwindled to less than 2/3 among the Fourthling chieftains. When his own name was called, the number of axes was far greater than expected. Balendilin gave him an approving nod. Tungdil's personal victory did nothing to change the end result. The majority had voted in favor of Gandagar, which amounted to a mandate for war. Bislapur held his head high. It was clear from his triumphant expression that he thought his work was done.
At this stage in the proceedings, it falls to me, the reigning High King, to approve the Assembly's choice,
declared Gundrabur.
Regrettably, in view of King Gandogar's foolish determination to steer our race toward destruction, I see no option but to declare him unfit for office. For that reason, I nominate Tungdil in his place. Who will back me?
Gandogar and Bislapur watched in stunned silence as a third of the delegates raised their axes, thereby investing Gundrabur with the authority to proceed. The hammer crashed noisily against the marble.
Then the succession shall be decided on merit. Our candidates will prove their ability in a contest. Gandogar and Tungdil will each nominate a task. Two further tasks will be set by the Assembly, and the fifth task will be drawn at random. You have 7 orbits to prepare.
With that, he called the hustings to a close. Dazed, Tungdil made his way along the line of supporters, who were queuing to pat him on the back, wish him well, and intercede with Vrakas on his behalf. Faces, beards, and chainmail loomed on either side of him, disappearing in a blur. His mind was reeling from the uncommonly strong beer and the exhilaration of success. It was incredible to think that dozens of dwarves had been won over by his arguments, but there was no escaping the knowledge that his triumph was founded on a lie. Although the chances of discovering anything about his provenance were slim, Belendalin had promised to do what he could to investigate without arousing suspicion. The counselor was too tactful to mention the possibility that the foundling was descended from Lorimbur's folk, and the notion of it seemed ludicrous to Tungdil, who felt comfortable living in Ogre's death, and shared nothing of the Thirdling's murderous dislike of other dwarves. In any case, there were more urgent matters than establishing his origins. First and foremost, he needed to practice his axemanship, in case Gandogar opted to challenge him to a duel. And he still had to settle on a task of his own. No one knew what to expect from the fifth and final task. Each candidate could nominate 4 challenges, and one would be drawn from a pouch. Only Vrakas could predict the outcome. Tungdil returned to his chamber to find Gorin's books and the contents of the leather bag strewn across his bed. Andukai must have broken the spell and examined the artifacts. He turned over the fragments of 2 silver-plated decanters and studied the runes. What a pity. If the inscriptions were to be